Thank you, Mark. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here, and I'm really grateful to the organizers for inviting me. It's been wonderful, I guess, a week now. And I hope that I'm going to be able to provide a slightly different perspective. I'm going to slightly change gears and even with respect to Ken's talk, and talk about more algebraic ways of looking at knots and links. So I've used a really, really nice quote that in these days, the angel of topology and the devil of abstract algebra fight for the soul of each individual mathematical domain. And I'm afraid that this is not going to be maybe more of a hell than heaven. But let's try to, I'll try to make it not as scary, mostly because, let me use another quote by Dror Bar-Natan, whom I respect a lot and whose contribution to the field is immense. So he says that the working mathematician fears fancy formulas, but likes pictures and diagrams. So this is the spirit of the talk. So what am I going to talk about? So this is a sort of more or less overview of the talk. I'll pick up where Ken left before the application part. So we'll start with the polynomial invariants for knots and links. So as Ken nicely said in his talk, there are many, so he sort of followed the development of knot theory. And as knot theory developed, people first start assigning numbers to knots and trying to distinguish in that way. For example, a knot is different than a two-component link. Well, okay, that's going to distinguish knots from links, but won't help us in distinguishing knots, and so on. And then, you know, we did get polynomials, but there are various more algebraic invariants that I won't be mentioning, unfortunately, in my talk, but we heard a little bit about them from Randy, such as a fundamental group of a knot complement and similar. So that's the sort of first slide that I'm going to mention. And then I'm going to introduce new invariants. So sort of there's going to be this interplay between classical and new or categorified invariants. And in particular, I am going to try to sort of just give you a little bit of a feeling or intuition what categorification might mean. There's no sort of rigid definition or formal definition what categorification really is. And then I will torture you with details of Hovanov's construction. So what Hovanov did roughly 10 years ago, a little bit more, so in 1999, 2000, he categorified the Jones polynomial, and that's so-called Hovanov homology. So we'll see a very detailed hands-on construction of Hovanov homology and a little bit about its properties, what are the benefits, and how it relates to other categorifications. So other knot polynomials have been categorified, and all these categorified theories are related. And they sort of provide a sort of a very wealthy source of studying knots and links. But categorification exists out of the realm of knot theory. And maybe in the very end, I'll say how it extends to tangles. Well, tangles are a part of knot theory, but also not related. So where categorifications appear outside of mathematics, but there are many more examples. Outside of knot theory, sorry. Okay, so here is what Ken taught us this morning. So most of the knot polynomials have a so-called skein relation somehow built into their definition. And one of the most general ones, one of the two-variable polynomials that Professor Millett mentioned, is a Homfly-PT polynomial, and here's the formula. So it's a two-variable polynomial which has like various specializations. So if we set variable A to be equal to Q to the n, and we sort of pick different values of for n. So for n equals to 0, we actually obtain the Alexander polynomial of a knot. For n equals 1, well, we don't really get a rich invariant. It's trivial. It's equal for all knots, just equal to 1. For n equal 2, we get the Jones polynomial. But there's no need to sort of work with only specific radius. There's so-called specific values. There's a so-called SLN polynomial that can be associated to any value of n. And they're all knot invariants. Okay, so all of these polynomial invariants have been categorified. And I know that we did not say yet what a categorification means, but let me just give an overview. So homeplied PT polynomial has been categorified by a triply graded Hovanov-Rosansky homology. So here's a little hint, because it's a two-variable polynomial, we'll need sort of to lift it, we'll need like a triply graded theory. All of these trees here lift one variable polynomial, so they'll be doubly graded. So sort of two-dimensional, you can think about. But this slide, sort of, what I meant to show with this slide is that they are, they're all categorified, but they're very, very, very different in flavor. So so now for a homology sort of related to more of gauge theory, Donaldson invariant, Seibert-Witten sort of counting holomorphic curves. Hovanov homology, well, they're all related to representation theory, but for example, there's a conjectural construction of Hovanov homology by Seidel and Smith that sort of has its roots in theory of Lagrangians. And then for Hovanov-Rosansky by graded theory, there's a work of, let's say, Kautis and Kamnitzer, which sort of work with coherent sheaves. So very, very different, but yet sort of unified theories. And they do provide sort of different information about knots. Okay, so here's my big picture for Hovanov homology. So for now, we'll sort of work with the Jones polynomial, or actually I'll lie a little bit, and as Ken nicely described, we can work with the Kaufman bracket version of the Jones polynomial up to sort of little things with orientation. But here's what we're working with. So what we're starting with is links. Links, let's say, in R3. And those can be considered as objects. So I'm slowly introducing the category theory language, but there's nothing to fear. So basically, we're going to be using only the simplest notions that we'll have objects and we'll have maps between them. So links live in, let's say, R3. So link cobordism will be a surface that lives in R4, or let's say R3 times an interval, such that, let's say, R3 times 0 is the first link, and R3 plus 1 is the second link, so it's a surface in R4 that has two boundary components, first link and the second link. So that's our link cobordism. So all of the classical invariants would work just with objects, so just with knots and links. So what we will do, we'll assign a certain polynomial or some other invariant to knot or a link. So what Hovanov did is that he assigned sort of an upgraded version of a Jones polynomial, which is in this particular case a homology U that I'll denote by K, H, or L. But also what's really, really important, he associates a natural algebraic object to the cobordism, to the map between these two objects. So
can I just have to make a question just to see if I'm thinking straight? So if we do the various moves that can describe changing crossings and so on, then we can always, I guess, go from one link to another by this kind of a cobordism.
Mm-hmm.
Adding
angles. Link cobordisms are sort of natural maps between links, so natural maps between homology groups would be homomorphisms of these homology groups, and I'll denote this thing by KH of S. So basically what this means is that one homology is a functor that sort of maps the category of link cobordisms into sort of algebraic category, a category of abelian groups and their maps. Or you could be sort of similarly thinking of category of vector spaces and linear maps between them.
Okay. How do I see which way the arrow goes? How do I see that it goes?
From topology to algebra.
No, I meant the arrow of the morphism.
Oriented cobordism?
It doesn't have to be, but yes, you can do both. It doesn't really matter for the theory, yes. I did not put any orientation or anything, but yes, they should be nicely oriented.
But given such a cobordism, there's also a homomorphism the other way, because
yes,
you could
do yes. Yes, so the reason why it's not there, it's not quite intrinsic to the. But we will be working with oriented links and oriented cobordisms eventually, just that.
And the Jones polynomial is like the Euler characteristic of the.
Yes, I'll get to that in a second. Yes. So let's see. This is the big picture. What can we do? What is the simplest thing that we can do? Well, let's find. I mean, I'm not really sure whether and how Hovanov was thinking about it, but let's sort of work with the simplest links that we can come up with. So just trivial links of n components. And let's try to come up with a homology theory for them. So what do I really mean by that? Well, just for sort of, this is like a technical detail. What I'm going to do, I'm going to sort of think of just circles, the collection of n circles non-intersecting as objects. And then what would the cobordism between them be? It's just sort of a surface that sort of has a certain number circles as in one and the other boundary. Okay, so basically, what I'm saying is the link homology of trivial links and their cobordisms will be actually be a two-dimensional TQFT. So what do I mean by that? To an empty knot or link, I'll assign some commutative ring R that I'll be working with. To an unknot, I'll assign a certain commutative Frobenius R algebra that I'll denote by A, and then to a collection of circles, so we sort of can see that we have a tensor function here, to K circles, I'll assign K copies of my algebra A.
So can I just ask, what's the Frobenius algebra?
I'll get to that in a second. So what I took care of here, I've assigned certain algebraic objects to, certain algebraic objects to the objects in my categories, to links and component links. Okay? But now I'll have maps between them. So I knew that I should have given a boring talk because I want to say something else. So what happens if I have just one circle and I want to map it into another circle? Well, the simplest cobordism I can draw between them is just the cylinder, right? Okay? Well, that should induce some map. So I'll have one copy of my algebra A here associated with this circle, another one here. Okay, let's say I'm mapping top to bottom, so there's an error here. So this cobordism here will is associate, I mean, should be associated, just the identity map between these two. Okay? And then there are some other maps. So if I have sort of a birth occurring here. So I had nothing and then a circle appears. That's a cap. Okay? So that will correspond to mapping my ring, commutative ring R, into my algebra A. The opposite, the death, will sort of induce a sort of a trace map that maps my algebra into the ring. And then there's like, well, a pair of pens, inverted or non-inverted, that will basically map two copies of my algebra A into A or the other way around. Okay, that's not that hard. That can be extended to any number of copies. And now, why the Frobenius type thing? Well, there are all these maps here. And what's really important is that, so if I look at this map here going in this direction, and let's say I have two copies of algebra, so technically I can think of these circles as being labeled by some elements of this algebra A. When I merge two circles into one, well, I can just multiply those labels. Okay? So this map here will be a sort of a multiplication map of my algebra. Okay? But if I reverse the arrow and I want to map A to two copies, two tensor, A tensor two, then what happens? I have one circle and I need to split it into two. So that's going to be a so-called co-multiplication map, a map that tells you how to split one thing into two things. Okay? And sort of an algebraic structure that tells you, that has all of these operations in it, and they sort of work nicely together. It's called the Frobenius algebra. More importantly, these operations sort of satisfy some relations, and these relations are really natural ones. Natural ones, when I say natural, I say natural to topologies. So if I'm drawing here, can everybody see? Yes? Okay, so let's say if I have three circles.
If you hit that leftmost light switch to your left, it will light up.
Yes. This is my magic trick. There have been no other tricks. Randy did them all. Obviously, one. Sorry. So in this setting, actually, so I have three circles, and let's say I first merge these two into one, and then I merge the third one with them. I can sort of see maybe this. Circles have labels A, B, and C, all elements of my algebra A. What am I going to get here? Well, let's think of this as a sort of bracketing operation. So this would be A, B, C. Okay? But what I can do them in a different order. So maybe I'll merge these two first. And then I'll merge A with them, the first one with them. And what this would be, it's going to be A bracket B, C. And so if we think about these things up to topological rules, then these two should be the same. Okay. And we are sort of trying to capture topology. So basically what this gives us is the fact that our algebra should be associative. So all of the relations in this Frobenius algebra basically come from topology that underlines this
structure.
There's more relations.
How does this have a common multiplication in these relations differ from the Hopf algebra?
So this is just a slightly different structure. So every finite dimensional Hopf algebra is a Frobenius algebra, but then. Okay, so now we kind of can get some algebraic theory, not kind of, we get a two dimensional TQFT, it's not a little thing, just based on trivial knots and links. So how are we going to extend it to all knots and links? Well, we do want to extend it to all knots and links in a meaningful way, and we want it to be related to the Jones polynomial. That's the game that we're playing in this talk. And if you want to do this, we actually have to specialize. We have to pick a certain Frobenius algebra. Okay, that choice actually turns out to be unique. I'm not going to, it's sort of a detailed thing, but it should be, it has to be a Frobenius algebra Z of X quotient by X squared. By quotient by X squared, I mean X squared is tends to zero. And that's actually governed by the normalization for the Jones polynomial, which is science. Q plus Q to the minus 1 to the algebra, to the unknot. And then, sort of, let me just describe the Frobenius algebra structure in this particular case of algebra Z of X quotient by X squared. Okay, so I do have a trace map which sends this algebra A into R, and I'll just send X to 1 and 1 to 0. That's natural. And it is a graded algebra. And again, as I said, degree of 1 will be minus 1. That's when you play a role of Q to the minus 1. And the degree of X will be equal to 1. That's when you play a role of Q. In our whole categorification business, and I still did not tell you about that. And here's sort of just like a little diagram which says, what do these maps do to the degrees? So sort of a trace map maps Z of X into just Z, so sort of lowers degree by 1, and then but also this one will lower degree because we'll introduce a Z in, it will include Z from our, 1 from our ring into Z times 1 in our algebra. What do all these degrees, do they have any kind of topological interpretation? Well, yes, so as we've said, as we've seen already, these maps are induced by cobordisms, okay? So actually, let's say, and this is really nicely seen by finding degrees for multiplication and co-multiplication. So tell me, what's the only characteristic of a pair of pens? Minus 1. So the rule that we are going to play is that the degree of something that's associated to a cobordism S, and in this case a cobordism is just a pair of pens, should be minus the order characteristic of that cobordism. So now I know that my multiplication and co-multiplication have to have degree 1. And in here's how they look like. This is just like a table on basis elements. So 1 times 1 is sent to 1. 1 times x or x times 1 is sent to x. And x tensor x is sent to 0.
So S is the morphism that represented by the arrow represented by the surface.
S is the cobordism.
Yeah.
And then, oh, I'm sorry, this should have been KH of S. I apologize, it's a mistake. KH of S is the map, yeah, it's associated. And now I just need to tell you if I have something labeled by 1, let's say this circle here, how many split it? Well, there are actually two choices. I'll either label one circle by 1, the other by X, or the other way around. And if I have a circle that's labeled by X, these two circles will be just labeled by X tensor X. Well, the reason for this is that, I mean, this is like a tensor functor. So if you have these two disjoint copies of your object, in this case a circle, it just gives you a tensor power of the object. Okay, any questions about this? So from now on, we'll be using this algebra C of X quotient by X, right, to build our category classification. And
the objects that you're talking about are just the topology of the objects themselves. There's nothing here about how these different objects are embedded in space. So before you showed us a picture of this link moving to the knot, but from this viewpoint, a link is just two rings and the knot is just one ring.
So what we're doing here basically restricted the theory of, I mean, the category of links and their cobordisms to a theory of category of trivial links and their cobordisms. So yes, I mean, I'm not using orientation, but yes, here you can sort of think that this inverted pair of tens is a cobordism between a trivial link of two components into a non-knot. So yes, this should sort of have a label S on them. And this particular cobordism is the one that introduces the multiplication on our algebra level.
So can I ask a question at the risk of getting off topic?
No.
So I understand the grading, just for a minute. So I just so the tensor square of A also gets a grading. One tensor one.
There's a shift that I'm
right about. Okay, so somehow you should, but this M that you have there, that is the KH of S in that picture, right? That's
yes. Yes.
So I should see somehow the grading is going down.
Yeah, so you have 1 plus 1 minus.
That was not a good example.
Sorry?
1 times 1, those have degree minus 1 and minus 1.
Right.
You multiply them together, you would have got degree minus 2, but the multiplication map has degree 1, so it raises it back up to minus 1, which is the correct answer.
Good, thanks. Okay, it raises it up.
Thank you. Okay, so before I actually go to the Hovano homology, let me give you sort of another point of view on categorification this time, which is sort of more, maybe more algebraic and very, very, very trivial. But just bear with me, I promise it's going to pay off. So categorification in terms that I'm using it here was introduced by Igor Frankl and Louis Crane and later popularized by Barnatan and Hovano. And here's one way of looking at it. So I want us to categorize something really, really, really simple. And you know, it's not going to give us any great inheritance or anything, but I think it's going to be sort of educational. And it is a building block on for quantum homology. So if I want to categorify integers, a natural thing to do is maybe to lift them to vector spaces, because each vector space is uniquely determined by its dimension. So what I can do, I can just replace integer, positive integer n by a vector space v whose dimension is equal to n. Any questions? Well, I hope that somebody will ask, so what? Well, maybe we can do a little bit more, and it is still, we can do a little bit more. So we can lift naturally some operations between integers, like addition and multiplication. But how about subtraction? Well, sure, that's, you know. Subtracting two numbers can be a negative number, and there are no vector spaces of negative numbers. So, any ideas what should we do? In some ways, yes. So there is like a basically algebraic topology construction, which says, well, I'll associate a vector space V to N, and I'll associate a vector space, let's say W to M, so that W has dimension M. But I'll change my category from category of vector spaces and linear maps within them into category of chain complexes of vector spaces, up to chain homotopy and so on. I'm sort of skipping details. So that I want to put V in the even homological degree and W in the odd homological degree, so that when I take Euler characteristic, this one comes with plus and this comes with a minus sign. So I actually lift or categorify N minus N. Okay, well, but now that I've done this, I need to go back and rethink what I did before, but that's not hard. So basically what I'm going to do, instead of assigning just a vector space, I'll assign just this very, very, very short complex to N. And then, you know, I'll take direct sum of complexes and tensor product of complexes here instead of tensor product, direct sums and tensor products of vector spaces. And this this is what we can do. So this is sort of a categorification of integers. Decategorification is a straightforward thing. You're just taking the order characteristic. And this is another question for my audience. This time I was not precise and I did not give you one piece of information. I said that I gave you a chain complex, but what I did, I only gave you vector spaces. I did not give you map between that. And this is a really, really important point. I mean, here it really doesn't matter because we're just categorifying integers for, you know, particular purpose. But basically, coming up with a map in your chain complex is the trickiest part of the whole construction, as you will see in further orthogonal homology. Okay, so I guess the natural question to ask, and I did not ask it here, is like, what is there anything that can be done with dividing integers? Yes, that's not an integer anymore, and that's an open question. So that, to my knowledge, nobody knows how to deal with.
Well, have you got anything then? Okay, the prime numbers, is there significance of prime numbers?
Not that I know of, so maybe. Okay, so this definitely looks like a baby example, but there are some really, really awesome examples that sort of follow the same construction. So in particular, categorification of the Jones and Alexander polynomial in the form of Hovanov or Knot-Flor homology defined by Oswald Szabo and Rasmussen are examples of this construction. And but I wanted to give you like a more, like first of all, a big picture, how this can be generalized, and then a really, really basic example that you all should be familiar with. So what we went here, we went from numbers, well, integer numbers, to, let's say, vector spaces. We could have used abelian groups. Well, why are abelian groups better or vector spaces better? But because they have operators, they have maps between them. Decategorification can be either just taking the dimension or the order characteristic, or in case of free abelian groups, rank. But there's no reason to stop here. If you're, let's say, given an abelian group or something, you can categorify that and maybe pick an abelian category. And why are categories better? Well, they have a rich algebraic structure. So if you do things right, they should provide more information about whatever we are studying with. So let's say if you had free abelian groups and some homomorphisms or endomorphisms of them, abelian group should be lifted to abelian category, homomorphism should be lifted to a functor, but then there's also natural transformations. Those are maps between functors. Okay, and then as Ken suggested, in the decategorification, in this case, is also straightforward construction. It's a called Grothendieck group or Grothendieck construction. Okay, so let's sort of stick with this part here. And what's the most basic example that I'm sure everybody here is familiar with? Well, that's categorifying the Euler characteristic, let's say, of a topological space. Nice topological space, so it exists, you can think of like a simplicial complex, into homology theory. So I know that it's known now, but you know, it is not known always. And let's say one way to come up with this is, you know, you take something I'll denote by X prime, which is, let's say, a CW decomposition of your space X, and let me denote by k sub I the number of I-dimensional cells in my CW decomposition. And then order characteristic has this really nice property that it can be interpreted in two ways. Either as an alternating sum of numbers of I-dimensional cells, or as the alternating sum of I-Pfeffi numbers, which is the ranks of homology groups. So I'll work here to build this homology theory. So what I'm going to do for each, let's say, five-dimensional cell, I'll add 0 goes to z goes to 0 into a chain complex in fifth place. For each 10-dimensional cell, I'll add this thing into 10th homological degree. And once I take homology of this constructed chain complex, it will have proper homology. It will have a homology that's homology in my topological space. Okay, so this is basically the categorification process, and the categorification is just taking the other characteristic of our topological space, and you know, in two-dimensional case, it's just a basic. So okay, vertices minus edges plus faces formula. Okay, so I don't think I need to remind you why homology is better than just the Euler characteristic. The most important one is that homology is a functor. So if I have two nice topological spaces and a continuous map between them, Euler characteristic will not tell me anything about the map, but homology will do. So this continuous map between topological spaces will induce a homomorphism between homology groups. Okay, so back to the version of the Jones polynomial that was described by Ken. So this is a Kaufman bracket version of the Jones polynomial. So I'm sort of sweeping things under the rug just for convenience. Kaufman bracket is actually not an invariant of oriented links, but of so-called framed links. You can just imagine your links being made not out of a string, but out of a flat ribbon. So in particular, they're not invariant under the first Rademeister move, but we've seen in Ken's talk that there's like a very easy way to compensate for that, by taking right into account. So Kaufman bracket polynomial is actually not quite a polynomial, it's a Laurent polynomial, but it has this nice kin relation built into it. So basically what we'll have to do, we have to deal with this recursive relation. Okay? So every time we see a crossing, we'll need to resolve it in two different ways. Well, I don't know whether Kaufman is motivated by physics or not, but there's definitely relations between the Potts model and the Kaufman bracket polynomial. So what he came up with is something that's called Kaufman state S, which is basically the following thing. You take a node diagram, and let's say that your node diagram has n crossings, in this case it's 3, and instead of doing applying skin relation recursively, I'm just going to take all 2 to the n possibilities and work with all of these states. So for each crossing I have 2 choices, so I have 2 to the n states. So Kaufman state is basically a map that sends crossings of your node diagram into plus or minus 1, each crossing. So a pictorial way of representing this that I will be using in my talk is just, well, if I have this crossing, I'll put a red horizontal bar into it, and that will denote horizontal smoothing, and then the vertical one will induce the other. It's a pictorial way of doing it. So let's go back to the formula. So Kaufman bracket is a Laurent polynomial. The variable I'll be using is A. And it's defined by following things. Like, so to an unknot, we assign minus A squared minus A to minus 2. This joint union, so basically if I have any link and I add an unknot to it, the value of the polynomial of that new link that I'm obtaining is just the value of the Kaufman bracket for the link we've started with times the value for the unknown. Okay? And then there's a skin relation which sort of relates Kaufman polynomials of these 3 knots that are the same except in this like little red circle where they have different solutions. Across the world. Okay? So this is not convenient for categorification. Instead, what Kaufman came up with, and I won't derive, but it's easy to derive, he came up with so-called state sum formula for the Kaufman bracket polynomial. And what it really is, it's a sum of monomials based on all of these states. So if I want to give you that formula, I need to describe define certain values that describe Kaufman states for you. So let's see, what do we have? Given a node diagram, well, at each crossing we have a choice. Do we smooth this way or this way? Okay? Well, this value sigma of s will tell me the difference. How many times I've smoothed one way and how many times I've smoothed the other way. Okay? So what am I going to, this is again a question for the audience because I don't have a picture, but it's a very easy question. So what do I get when I smooth every single crossing, either way? Just a collection of circles. And that's good news because we know how to deal with trivial knots and links. Okay? So d sub s will be a system of circles that's going to be obtained by smoothing a diagram v of my knot according to some choice of plus and minus markers. Okay? Well, if I do this, the sum I'm going to get is not going to be sum of monomials. It's going to be the sum that's going to have this term, the value of the unknot, as the building block. It's just going to be minus a to minus 2 minus a squared to some power. But I want the sum of monomials. So in order to do that, and this is a really, really pretty trick. So basically, if I'll have some power of this value, and I want to expand it. OK? But how am I going to do it? Well, I'll either pick this one, a squared to minus 2, or a squared. And the way to do it is to label each circle by, let's say, plus or minus, or 1 and x. Let's label it by 1 and x. So basically, what I'm describing now is so-called enhanced Kaufman state, which is just a collection of circles obtained by smoothing a diagram. An example is coming up in a second. Labeled by 1 and x. Labeled by 1 and x because that should be reminiscent of the algebra that we're using here. So Kaufman in his paper uses plus and minus originally. Okay, and then sort of as an analogy to sigma of s, I'll introduce the tau of s, which will sort of be just the number of positive circles minus number of negative circles, or number of circles labeled by x minus number of circles labeled by 1. Okay, so how does this look like? Here's an example. Kopfling, two crossings. That means that my cube will have two squared smoothings. So here's one, where both crossings are smoothed in a positive way. Here I've changed just one to a negative one. Here I can change the other one, and here both are negative. So basically this thing represented here is a Kaufman state, let's say plus one, plus one. Okay? Well, I said that these circles that I'm obtaining, I need to sort of upgrade them, label them, according to the algebra Z of X quotient by X squared that I'm going to be using. So let me do that. This is just an example of how it can be done. And what this enables me to do is to write my Kaufman bracket polynomial as a sum of monomials over I and J. Well, those are going to be two parameters that are going to depend on sigma and tau, which describe each enhanced Kaufman state. And now let's think about it. This coefficient here of my A to the J is an integer. It's a number of certain of Kaufman states with certain properties. And I know how to categorify integers. I'll realize that integer as, in this case, a rank of some group that I'll call Cij, and I want it to be a group for that's going to be building blocks of Kaufman homology. Okay? Well, if I want to do that, there's a natural choice for generators of this group. So basically what I'm saying here is that Kaufman chain group Ci of a diagram D is going to be the sum of, well, or Cij of D, which will be a sum of three groups freely generated by all enhanced Kaufman states. That's it. Now that I have the groups, I need to come up with a map. And this is like the really beautiful, slightly detailed part, but just bear with me. So what happens? I have this collection of circles, and they have two things associated to them. Whether crossings were smooth, had positive or negative resolution, and what their label is, 1 or x. So let's take the first thing into account. If I have one sort of smoothing, I can change it into another sort of smoothing. What happens when I do that? Well, two things can happen. I'm showing sort of a simplified version here. So basically, I can have anything like here on the outside, but let me close it in the most simple way. So if I change this smoothing into this smoothing, these two circles will merge. In this case, I have multiplication. The same here and the same here. I just have different labels, and the multiplication works according to our Frobenius algebra structure. But if the connections were different, so if these two arcs were actually connected on top, as shown in this picture here, I'll have one circle splitting into two, and I'll split the label according to the co-multiplication rule in my Frobenius algebra. And basically, this is how the differential in Hovanov homology is defined. So basically, what I have here, I have chain groups, I have the differential map, and I say that Hovanov homology is just the homology of this chain complex. Okay, well, let's see the example. These are the Kaufman states. To each circle, I'll assign one copy of my algebra z of x quotient by x squared. Okay, so, and here are the maps between them, because I'm merging two circles into one and splitting one circle into two. So this is what I just said. I have two copies, one copy here, and two copies here. So they're formed in this sort of nice two-dimensional cube. In general, it will be n-dimensional cube. And what I'm going to do, I'm just going to flatten this cube problem. So I just take the total complex here, and what I'm going to get is, so this is describing one of homology for the Hopf thing. Okay.
And there's no role here that the projection says your two A tensor twos have different Euler characteristics.
No, doesn't matter. And actually, I'll have to put the sign here, but that'll be on the next slide. So, a general thing. I'm ignoring those gradings, and I will, because it's just technical, right? Not enlightening. But so I'm ignoring the grading, but what I have, if I have a diagram with n crossings, I'll have 2 to the n resolutions, so and I'll organize them in an n-dimensional cube. They will be, each edge of a cube will represent a map. So either multiplication or co-multiplication. And it, the way that I presented it on the previous slide here, each square is commute. That's something you need to check, but it works. But we want things to anti-commute. We want, so we need to sprinkle signs, and that can be done in a consistent way. Moreover, when you sprinkle signs, you'll actually get a very, very important condition without d squared equals zero, and there's no homology without that condition. And what's important to say is that the resulting homology does not depend on this choice of signs. It can be done sort of in a nice way. So basically, all that has changed from the previous one is that I've added the minus sign here on one edge to make this square anti-commute. Okay, so this is a construction, hands-on construction of Polanyi homology. I guess it's almost obvious to see that its graded Euler characteristic is the Kaufman bracket version of the Jones polynomial. But what I, but here's some examples. So here's the Jones polynomial of this trefoil here, and here's how we can represent its homology. So basically, these ones here represent just copies of Z. So wherever you see one, think of it as having a Z here. And let's say if we sort of sum things up this way, we're exactly going to get the powers of. So basically what we realized is, I mean, unfortunately, this is quite a boring example because all the coefficients are 1, but still, sort of, rank of this Z here is 1, and so on, and it comes equivalent to the sign. It's not a particularly impressive example, but still. Okay. So here's a more interesting example for more than one reason. It's a torus knot, T65, and torus knots are actually the first knots that have been computationally shown to have torsion. So
torsion.
So let me sort of decipher this table for you. So these are our Arthur J grading, but you see wherever you see one, that means a copy of Z exists there. But whenever you see 1 sub 2, that means that there's 1 Z2 grading. And you can see here that there's a lots of Z2s, but there's 1 Z5 here and 1 Z5 here. So I'll talk about torsion of one homology in like a couple of slides, and this is like really, really, really interesting. So basically, taking Euler characteristic of one homology, we'll only capture information about the ranks of homology groups. It will tell us nothing about torsion. So basically, torsion is the first sort of obvious extra piece of information that one homology has that Jones polynomial doesn't.
I just want to be enlightened about the indexing of the rows and the columns. Just help me understand that these are the I's and the J's somehow, but can you just, maybe go back one, actually, to this.
Yes and no. So I prefer I prefer not to discuss this in detail, but basically it's related to, it's not straightforward. It depends on the number of crossings and resolutions and everything, but it basically goes back to, I'm first showing you the Jones polynomial version, but it goes back to sort of this relation here, and memorization. It's not really worth you know, a lot of thought into it. So I think it's times 2 minus 1 gives you the, so this guy, let's say, divided by 2 plus 1 gives you the power or something.
That's what you get beyond.
Yep. But I was not precise here, so don't hold me on this one. Okay, so far, I did not tell you the most important thing. So the construction that I've shown you here was dependent on a diagram of a knot. Okay, and it's really, really important to prove that Hovanov homology does not depend on the choice of diagram. The way you do that, you just show that it does not depend, that it's invariant under all master rules. And it is. So a beautiful theorem, first proved by Magnus Jacobson and then by Mikhail, well, kind of independently by Mikhail Hovanov, is that Hovanov homology is functorial. And we've already discussed this. So basically, a link homomorphism between two links induces a homomorphism between homology groups. But it's a meaningful construction. That means that it lifts properties of the Jones polynomial. In particular, the skin relation, the definite skin relation, is lifted to this short exact sequence on the level of chain homology, on the level of chain groups, sorry. And then this one induces the long exact sequence of homology groups. For those who are interested, and I know there's a lot of interest in human form homology, in their case, the skin relation is actually lifted to an exact triangle. But they're always lifted. So, I guess one thing that I did not mention here, for example, span of the Jones polynomial, so the difference between the highest power and the lowest power gives you an estimate of the minimum number of crossings for your knot. And the same holds for the width of the homology. So the difference between the lowest homological gradient and the highest homological gradient.
So the homomorphism is actually a concordance. It's really a cylinder. And does that induce an isomorphism, or is that too much?
No. And you need to show that these are independent on the choice of cohomology. I mean, you actually need to show that homomorphism will not depend on the choice of cohomorphism between these two knots.
And so I was just wondering about the case. If the two links are concordant, so that's great. That's a, but earlier you convinced me that any two links were coordinate. Mm-hmm. But if they're concordant, that's a much stricter thing. I mean,
right. So there's this sort of. So later I'll mention there's like a nice sort of range of like isotopy, concordance, homotopy, invariants that sort of are related to Hovanov homology. But yeah. Okay. So. Let's sort of say things straight. Oh, God, okay. So Hovanov homology is a stronger invariant than the Jones polynomial. And a paper by Barnard Tan, who was the first one to sort of, after Hovanov published a paper on Hovanov homology, gives us example of two knots. One is 5-crossing knot, one is a 10-crossing knot, which have different Hovanov homology, but same Jones polynomial. So Hovanov homology is definitely a stronger invariant, and then one piece of information that it carries extra is torsion. Torsion in Hovanov homology is somewhat understood, but definitely not completely described. There was a conjecture by Alexander Shumakovich which says that every link, except the trivial knot, the Hopf link that we've seen before, and connected sums and this joint union of these, have Z2 continuous. So he proved the conjecture for the class of alternating links, and he actually proved more, that not only the torsion of order 2 appears, but only Z2 torsion appears. So not 4, 8, and so on. But then, as we've seen on the example of a torus knot, Barnatan made a program, computed things, and actually discovered that there is a torsion, odd torsion in torus knots. So in particular, the knot, torus knot 8, 7 has Z3, Z5, and Z7 torsion. It's one of those. And then Marko Stošić described the Hovanov homology of torus knots sort of theoretically. And here's what we did. We sort of extended and proved Shumakovich's conjecture for a larger class of knots and links, which are adequate and semi-adequate links. And this actually has been done in a very combinatorial and algebraic way by relating knots to certain graphs. So you can actually express Hovanov homology of a knot in terms of combinatorial data for a graph. And in particular, this has applications to positive braids. Here we see application to positive 3 braids. This braid here corresponds to knot 1052, And what we can show that in a certain sort of external gradient, you can sort of think of approximating Hoehn homology in like both corners. So one of them doesn't have torsion because the gravity corresponds to it. This looks like this. It's like a bunch of multiple edges. But the other one has a beautiful butterfly associated to it. And hence it has torsion. Okay, so as I promised Rob, here are some nice applications of homology. So Jake Rasmussen and Yuson Lee gave a combinatorial proof of Krautheimer-Mruca's theorem, which was earlier known as Euler's conjecture, about the slice genus of a knot. And this proof is purely combinatorial. The only known proof was very, very involved and included lots of gauge theory in it. And then Jake Rasmussen actually defined this combinatorial invariant called S invariant, which is a concordance invariant. And in particular, what it gives it a lower bound for the slice genus here. And then Hovannov homology is related to Knot-Flor homology, which is categorifying the Alexander polynomial. And I guess in the last, maybe 4 years, there have been like a lot of work done, like a body of work done on this particular thing. There's various spectral sequences between these two homology theories, one constructed by Peter Osbert and Zoltan Szabo, which basically relates Hovannov homology of a knot with Z coefficients to Knot-Flor homology, a hat version, of a branch double cover of a knot. So basically what this means is that you start with Hovannov homology and somewhere in infinity, you get here four as an infinity term. And again, a very, very exciting development in 2010 by Tom Ruka and Peter Kronheimer. They've constructed a different spectral sequence which works only with Z2 coefficients, if I'm not mistaken, from Hovannov homology to, I think, monopole version or instanton version. Then John Bloom did the other one. And the idea is that if you apply a spectral sequence to your homology theory, there's no loss of information. Okay? So you've started with
Hovannov homology, does it detect mutation?
No. Yeah, there's a work of Stefan Verli and Jonathan Boo, yeah, about it. So, let me just finish. So the idea is that you have a spectral sequence of Hovannov homology to Higgert flow homology, and there's no loss of information. Higgert flow homology detects the unknown, hence Hovannov homology has to detect the unknown. So that's like an implicit proof that Hovannov homology distinguishes the unknown, but this is still an open question for the Jones polynomial. And this proof cannot be decategorified so far, or it wasn't so far. There's an obvious way to decategorify it. Okay, so I guess I'm mostly out of time, so let me just skip through this. Hovannov homology can be extended to tangles. Did I skip a slide? Okay, but there are many, many other categorizations that live outside of knot theory. So in particular, Hovannov and Lauda categorify quantum groups, independently Cautis and Licata and Hovannov Heisenberg algebras, and then there are many, many other sort of planar type algebras that have been categorified. Ben Webster categorified the Rishitig into Rive invariants, and then there is a way to categorify just the polynomial ring. With one variable and integer coefficient z of x. The way it's done, I just wanted to show an example. This is a joint work with Hovannov, where we categorified Hermite polynomials using pictures of this type that are sort of tangle-like. I'm just drawing them horizontally, where you have a certain number of left endpoints and a certain number of right endpoints. The choice of these diagrams is actually determined by the inner product between x to the m and x to the n. That's the defining one for the Hermite polynomials, which is actually equal to m plus m minus 1 double factorial, which is equal to the number of connections between m plus m endpoints, if you include crossings. And then it's more or less done up to isotopy, but you sort of don't want all of them. You cannot straighten returns and stuff like that. And then you cook up the sort of Grothendieck type theory for it, and you assign different types of modules to each kind of diagrams, and if you decategorify them, so compute the growth in the group, what you're going to get, that projective modules will correspond to sort of basic building blocks, so monomials, and big standard modules, which are defined by these pictures that are sort of almost generic, they just don't have returns on the right, correspond to Hermite polynomials. Anyways, I'm sorry that I went over time. I'll thank you for your attention.
Any questions? Yes. So you go back a couple. You gave the slice genus thing. So I'm just, so is there, so that's when it's concordant to nothing. Mm-hmm. Is there some, I just want to get somebody, do you know if there's some result that sort of compares at the level of, this is an application, but compares the homology of concordant lakes, and sort of what goes into that?
So I'm not sure, but I know where to look for it, and it's work of Lawrence Roberts, and it's sort of definitely an interplay between homology and Hilbert homology.
I wonder what's the role of can you see something on the CDF type in this context?
I would prefer not to. Yeah, I don't know. We can talk later, but yes, not that bad. So sort of. This is has like a really strong sort of PQFT flavor, where you can sort of think of Hermite homology maybe as a four-dimensional or 3+1-dimensional PQFT that's just restricted to these particular objects that are knots and their coercions.
Do you think that there's any way that you can generalize the sort of topological structure of knots that you're interested in? So, for example, sort of objects that maybe have filaments that branch. Can that be handled at all by this approach?
Branch in terms of like trivalent?
Yeah, so for example, these, say, beta curves that people talk about.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, sure, maybe it's the Hermann-Rosansky homology that's like more pertinent to that particular problem.
But it's a sort of overview of more general structure.
Ken's
talking about sort of open-ended curves.
So with open-ended curves, there's no theory for like open-ended knots, but there is homology for tangles, which are, I guess, sort of can be thought of as building blocks for knots and links, and sort of the whole theory extends. I mean. The classical invariant extends, so basically you can extend the Jones polynomial to tangles and get something that's related to representation theory of UPSO2, and then when you extend Kovanov subtraction to tangles, you actually categorify that new invariant. I mean, not new invariant, but extended classical invariant in some ways, but...
yeah, these don't branch, I guess.
No, they're not that. I'm just saying that so sort of a different theory of Hermann-Rosansky can be sort of interpreted in some sort of trivalent graphs type structure and study tree. So that's why I said that maybe it's Hermann-Rosansky homology that's going to give relevant information to that, not the Jones type theory. I mean, for that matter, there are various graph polynomials that have also been categorized. So if you think of the chromatic polynomial for graphs, or dichromatic, or cuts. There are homology theories that categorify those in much the same way as homology categorifies. So what's been unknown is, for example, Jones polynomial could definitely be seen as a specialization of the cut polynomial, which is the most general two-variable graph polynomial that satisfies deletion contraction relation. but so far I don't think it's known whether the categorization of the Taft polynomial can give us anything. We're not here. Because in some ways the polynomial is more general, but it's sort of loose topology. There's no topological restrictions.
So this picture you have here with the morphism, picture one, are there cross-sea relations? Are there relations between tangles that go from 5 to 3 to tangles that go from 4 to 4? Like it, as if you picked up one of those blue dots and dragged it up and made it a red dot?
Well, maybe not necessarily in that way. But yes, you can definitely compose tangles either vertically, sort of braid side, or by tensoring at the second
end. I'm looking at your picture there.
So it's fine.
There's this, you have this tangle with 5 blue dots and 3 red dots.
Oh, and you want to turn this one back?
And now imagine that instead I had 4 red dots and 4 blue dots. I picked one of the blue dots up and dragged it across to the red side. Are there relations between do you get relations between those tangles?
Okay, I'm not really sure what the question is.
Pick up.
Okay, basically, I'm
a mathematician.
Sorry. If you think, so what I have here, maybe this will answer your question. So what I have here is sort of like, again, category theoretical explanation, but there's no need to think about it. So what objects are just integers n. I'll draw them as dots. So then what a tangle is just a map between three, in this case, n dots and m dots.
Yeah.
Okay? Well, I mean, just imagine if I want to map it into 7 dots, I can stick another tangle here and consider that one as a map. Okay?
No.
I
want to take your graph one, that one with the 3 red dots, maps from 3 dots to 5 dots. Yeah. And relate them to maps with 4 dots to 4 dots.
Okay, do you want a 3D version or a 2D version? So there's definitely a cobordism that will sort of like take no crossing that corresponds to just one strand here and take it into a Rademeister one move.
Well, that's getting there, but
can you change the boundary conditions in it's a definition of a tangle cobordism.
You fix the endpoints.
No,
you fix the endpoints.
So he wants a more general case where the boundary conditions can change, where he could move one of the blue boundary conditions off to a red boundary condition.
Yeah, I could take one of the bright.
There's an obvious sort of
right,
gap between them, right? But that move probably doesn't satisfy the condition, condition of tangle cobordism.
Yeah.
So there should be some more general thing, perhaps. It would be nice to understand how those work.
Because it would be very natural, right, to...
Something like a stabilization.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm thinking about, whether...
We can imagine just doing...
Adding a strand.
On the right-hand side, take your first 4, bring them down, and compose with one that has a little cup, and then somehow you're going to be adding that on, it'll sort of stabilize in both directions.
That somehow sort of implies that you're closing them, right?
No, not necessarily. I mean, it'd be analogous to that. Mm-hmm. So just remember, see your bottom dot on the right-hand side?
Mm-hmm.
Imagine you have a little cup there.
Like this?
And now go straight up.
Mm-hmm.
All the way to the top?
Sure.
So now you have a new kind of composition because you have something coming down and that thing sort of multiplying on the side. So I don't think
So you can definitely have a stabilization move where you sort of add the strand and then you do the composition. But basically what you're saying now will actually be what I've sort of suggested in the beginning. So I guess that Ken and I now have a joint explanation. So let's say if I had a tree candle like this, and let's say I wanted to move this dot up, I can definitely do a stabilization move when I add one more strand. But then what adding a cup basically would be composing with, I don't know what here, but definitely with a tangle that's maybe some 4-0 tangle that has nothing here and just a cup here. So, I'm sure there are a bunch of moves that can be defined, and I guess all that we would need to check is that you get a closed subset or subcategory of a tangle category, and then you can work with it. I guess you just need to figure out your problem.
Kind of operation.
But so far, it's sort of like with braids. I have two tangles, T1 and T2. If I want to combine them vertically, they have to send the same number of boundary points here. And then I can sort of have the tensor product type thing where I just combine them.
And you can join them. So you can link the different sectors together this way.
Yes.
So, I mean, you could imagine a different theory where you have a circle with an even number of points and some kind of tangle between them, and now you have to divide the circle in half to give a representation like this.
Actually,
in a way, what Randy's suggesting is sort of relate the theories to different divisions of the circle.
Okay, since this is a discussion type thing, so these are excellent ideas, and they're actually used either actually for categorification of polynomials that are not related to knots, but also that is kind of how one categorifies tangles in general into this homology. So actually, let me just show you one picture. So, anyways, okay, I have to show more than one picture. But let's say that you have even number of points, so tangles that are even, so even number of points on both top and bottom. But let's consider like a very simple tangle. So by the way, knots and links are just 0-0 tangles. There's nothing on the boundary. They're just closed circles. So here, I'm considering something that has no endpoints on one side, but let's say 2 × 3, 6 endpoints here. So what are all possible crossingless connections? Well, I have them here. Okay? How can I combine them to get circles? I know what to do with circles. Well, I'll reflect along the horizontal axis, and then I'll compose them. And here's an example. If this is my B, I reflect it, I get this diagram, and I just compose it, I get two circles. And I know what to associate to two circles. Okay, great, but where are we going to do stick tangles in this whole story? Well, let me just do the following thing. Let me just kind of take this like middle part here, well, and stretch it. And I get this identity tangle on six strands. Well, there's no need to have just identity tangle here. What I'm going to do, I'm going to take any tangle T, stick it in the middle, and take all possible closures on top and bottom. So that's part of the construction of the tangles. So that's an excellent idea.
So, yes, you can.
From this approach, do we learn anything deeper on the coefficients of knot polynomials?
So, well, deeper or not, you sort of get a more refined information. So not in my examples, really. Oh, actually, maybe I did not look at it carefully. But technically, yeah, so maybe you do. So let's see here, I have 1 and 1. If I collapse this way to get what the coefficient or whatever power should be here, maybe q to the 17th, I don't remember exactly. Well, this one and this one cancel because they come with a different sign. So basically, I know that there's no power of q in the Jones polynomial here, but I have this extra information that there was a z and there was a z in like two neighboring homological gradings. So in this sense, yes, you do get a more refined information. Or for example, here, this one and this one will cancel, but this one will contribute +1 to, well, it won't be q to the 27, but it would be maybe q to the, well, I don't know. Exactly.
So if I want to compute this polynomial, mm-hmm. does this simplify the procedure?
No, it's just a shadow, it's just more complicated. So it's known that Jones polynomial is empty, computing a Jones polynomial is empty hard. Complexity is exponential, it's good to the end. So, yes.
So this isn't any harder.
Well, you know, it's built on the, well, it is in some ways, because it goes on the same state sum.
It's not algorithmic.
That's right.
It's not algorithmic. Sorry?
It's algorithmic. There's an algorithm to do this.
No, there's an algorithm, and there are two wonderful programs. I mean, the old one and the first one by Barnatan, another one by Alexander Shumakovich, and now, I guess, you know, we're all putting our hopes like into this student at Princeton, Cottonseed, who's like a professional professor and has a program for computing Hovannov homology. And actually, I think he's writing a program for something that's really, really exciting. So Shuchit Sarkar and Robert Lipschitz have constructed a different invariant that's related to Hovannov homology, but basically they've constructed a space whose homology is Hovannon homology or not.
That's what I was about to ask about, but it's sort of related to something Randy asked in the last talk, which is just whether there's some way, I mean, this is bigraded, so it's a little bit hard to think about it like a cell decomposition, because I don't know how to think about the bigrade, but I mean, they could construct some space whose homotopy type is the bigrade, and then the homology of that is Hovannov, or maybe the triply graded one, I'm not sure what.
No, it's Hovannov, yeah.
But is there, this is very speculative, so it's fair to anybody too, but is there some way to think of the information that you're seeing, I mean, as you're describing these cancel when you're looking at jet, when you project this way, but sort of think of it somehow as handles? I mean, there's some kind of, yeah.
Well, I mean, a bigrading is natural when you have a filter complex, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, just trying to think how to.
I think it's not a question.
There's a space with the Morse function.
Well, it's like some higher order Morse function. Yeah, it's like, right. It's taking into account the filtering of the multiple grading.
Is this light genus equal to the minimal genus of the cipher surface of the knot, or it has nothing to do
for
with?
For positive knot, it's equal to the cipher genus. So positive knots are just positive. The ones with positive crossings only, but they're not now.
Very well, that's time for our dinner again.